From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 403 for this June the 24th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. Taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, our long distance number 1-800-580-2372. So I have a couple of questions for you. I wanted to have a little bit of fun, but to denote some of the issues being discussed in the Public Library of Science Journal, Public Library of Science Medicine Journal this past week and up for the next 2 weeks from this time. It is a series on big food. That is the companies that produce more than half, and I think now it's even greater than that, but more than half of all the food that we consume and is produced is controlled by a small handful of companies that make this food. And a couple of authors who have published various opinion pieces and also with references to support their opinion, Marion Nestle from New York University and David Stuckler from Cambridge University, have said the following. They're saying that food, unlike tobacco and drugs, is necessary to live and essential to health and disease. And yet the big multinational food companies control what people everywhere eat, resulting in a stark and sick irony. 1 billion people on the planet are hungry, while 2 billion are obese or overweight. They also go on to say that the large food and beverage companies play a major role on the global health stage by rebranding their companies as, quote, nutrition companies, unquote, and marketing their people as experts in malnutrition, obesity, and even poverty at major conferences and UN meetings. But their primary goal is to drive profit through food sales. The editors therefore raise this question. And it's a question I'm more than happy to put out to you and would like to know your thoughts about this as well. Why does the global health community find this acceptable? And how do these conflict of interest play out? So they go on to say the public health response to big food has so far created as a failure to act and argue public health professionals must recognize that big food's influence on global food systems is a problem and do what is needed to reach a consensus about how to engage this critically. And they propose several things, and I want to know what you think about this. They propose that they should support initiatives such as restrictions on marketing to children, better nutrition standards for school meals, and taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. The central aim of public health must be to bring into alignment big food's profit motives with public health goals. Without taking direct and concerted action to expose and regulate the vested interests of big food, epidemics of poverty, hunger, and obesity are likely to become more acute. And they go on in several other papers to make note of how they have what's called corporate social responsibility campaigns, or CSRs, corporate social responsibility. And there are campaigns that they outline from PepsiCo and Coca-Cola in a policy form article. And they state that even though soda companies are not looked upon as having the same social stigma or regulatory pressure as tobacco companies, the concern with regard to soda and obesity epidemic is nevertheless increasing. They argue that soda companies launched comprehensive corporate social responsibility initiatives in response to health concerns about their products sooner than tobacco companies, and those campaigns mirrored those of the tobacco companies as far as using corporate social responsibility to place responsibility on the consumers instead of on the corporation and to improve the popularity of their company and product, as well as to prevent regulation. So in other words, what they're saying is that the companies, for example, they reinforce the idea that obesity is caused by the customer's bad behavior, diverting attention from, in this case, if we use an example, soda's contribution to increasing obesity rates. And so they tend to focus on you know, setting up some parks, getting kids to exercise, but they divert your attention towards that, and they don't really admit in any way, shape, or form that what they are making for people to eat is potentially harmful for them over the long term. So I'd like to know your idea about that. It's a bit controversial. It is something, though, that we should address, because this type of corporate marketing, we see it everywhere, is still something that it bothers me to a certain extent because of what I tend to see in my office, what we see with regards to public health, and also with rising rates of obesity. And to that end, I want to ask you a question. And don't go look this up. I really just want you to call in and let me know what you think has the most calories. And believe it or not, Burger King, and why people think this stuff up, I don't know. But Burger King has developed a bacon sundae. That's right. It is a bacon sundae. It has 510 calories, 15 teaspoons of sugar, and bacon. And there was a hullabaloo about that with regards to, geez, another type of Frankenfood. And yet, my questions are, who thinks this stuff up? Why do they think it can sell? Why does it sell? Why do people buy it? It just seems to me meat with cream doesn't seem to mix together too well, yet they're making it. So using that as our template for 510 calories for this particular dessert, there are a whole slew of other desserts that are out there. There's carrot cake. And in fact, there's the Keg carrot cake a la mode. There is the Outback Steakhouse Chocolate Thunder from Down Under. There's Denny's Oreo Blender Blaster. There's McDonald's Large Rollo McFlurry. There's the Dairy Queen Banana Cream Pie Blizzard. There's a whole bunch of them out there. What I want to know from you, and we'll go over this list, you know, when you call in, if you want to sort of play this game, I'm going to give you all these names, and you can sort of take a guess, because remember, when you go into the restaurants, a lot of these desserts don't have listings of how many calories there are, at least easily or readily available. So if you were given these particular numbers about these particular desserts, if you were thinking of having dessert, would it change your mind? Would it make you determine that, well, maybe I won't have a dessert, maybe I'll have something else? But keep in mind that these are common desserts. These are items on menus that sell. Because if they weren't on there, if they weren't selling, they would not be on these menus anymore. So obviously people are buying enough of these to justify the continued selling of these products, these food products. So again, our base dessert for frame of reference is Burger King's Bacon Sundae with 510 calories and 15 teaspoons of sugar. And the list of other desserts, McDonald's Large Rollo McFlurry, Denny's Oreo Blender Blaster, Cold Stone Creamery Gotta Have It Oreo Cream Ice Cream, Cinnabon Pecan Bun, Dairy Queen Banana Cream Pie Blizzard, Chili's Chocolate Chip Paradise Pie, Applebee's Chocolate Chip Cookie Sundae, Outback Steakhouse Chocolate Thunder from Down Under, the Cheesecake Factory Chocolate Tower Truffle Cake, and the Keg Carrot Cake a la mode. And I don't expect you to remember all of those, but those were the desserts listed out there, very common, very popular desserts. And I'm curious if you just want to play along. I think this might be some fun just to go over what you think is in there, how much you think is in there, and what it would take actually to eliminate those calories being consumed, or what it actually is equivalent to in terms of your total daily requirements. Remember, this is a dessert after the huge portion sizes that many of these restaurants, full-service restaurants, provide. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. All our lines are available. I do not want to talk to myself for the next 45 minutes. I would prefer if you called in and we had a nice discussion. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
New boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. And just to also, for a reminder, next week we will not be on. It is Canada Day. But the week after, journalist Dan Gardner and well-known Dr. Yoni Friedhoff will be here. Dan will actually be calling in. Yoni will be here. And we're going to be talking about an article Dan wrote about Michael Bloomberg's decision in mayor of New York to restrict the sizes of sodas sold in various venues. Restricting the sizes so that you can't buy 64 ounces of soda. some of the evidence that suggests that by limiting sizes and limiting portion sizes, you can influence a person's intake. So that should make for a good discussion. People are certainly more than welcome. Our listeners more than welcome to call in on that day to voice their comments and arguments. I'm certainly looking forward to that. That is 2 weeks from now on July the 8th. Now, turning back to our calories and food, welcome Mike in Greeley.
Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you.
Likewise.
First of all, I appreciate your honesty and your practicality around medicine. It's very enlightening.
Thank you.
Oh, before we get started, I'm not sure what the process is, but I'd like to guess.
Sure.
Of the choices that you provided, which one I think would be the highest calorie?
Sure. You want me to read off the list?
No,
you got it?
Because one really stood out for me.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was the cheesecake.
Okay.
But the thing that scares me a bit is when you're talking bacon and
yes.
Is that deep fried?
It is essentially, it's called a bacon sundae. They list on their panel screen at Burger King, there's a picture of this. They actually list the calories. It costs $2.99 for 510 calories, mm-hmm. and that is the bacon sundae. So,
good price too, eh, Barry?
Yeah, that's right. And to give you an idea of what 510 calories is, 510 calories is the equivalent of an 80-kilogram person running for an hour at 4 miles per hour, will burn.
And 500. I understand that inside out because I do run and I try to reduce my.
Yeah. So it just gives you an idea when someone goes out, and a lot of people don't do that, right? They go, they may exercise a little bit, and they go, well, I've exercised, I think I've done a good job. And then they go and they have this, and they've eaten twice as many calories as they may have burned off by exercising.
Big deficit. Okay, so this is interesting. I'm going to be listening to.
Yeah, sure. So you think it's a cheesecake?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You got a lot of things going together, but I could be wrong.
Well, I will definitely, before the end of the show, I will definitely give the answers to all the calories, and I can guarantee you people are going to be very surprised
any other questions other than just the calories? Were we mentioning how many?
Well, they had, teaspoons of sugar were also in there.
Okay, so let me give a guess to that.
Sure.
For a cheesecake, which I've made quite a bit. Yeah, you're talking. I wish I knew my cups to my teaspoons thing.
Well, a teaspoon is a teaspoon is about 5 grams,
yeah.
And 28 grams for. So say about 6 teaspoons for every ounce.
Okay, then 48.
You're close. You're close. In fact, I'm going to give this one to you because you were close. It is 51.5 teaspoons of sugar. And this particular cheesecake, okay, is 1,679 calories in one slice, right? So that is pretty much a woman's, for an average-sized woman, her daily allowance of calories in that piece of cake.
Goodness.
And to tell you, Mike, that's not the worst one.
That isn't the worst
that
one.
That isn't
okay,
the worst
well,
one.
At least I can close on one.
Right.
And I am listening very eagerly to see what the other ones
are. Sure, sure. And I'll read out that list for people, too. But I figured this would be fun today because it really, I'll ask people to guess how many calories as well, because that might be helpful.
Yes.
Because people, it's interesting to see what people estimate as being the energy equivalent in the food that they're eating.
Well, Barry, just an excellent way to get people to pay attention, right. Have fun, and learn something. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to go and continue in this vein. Telbis in North Lancaster, good afternoon.
Hi. How are you today, doctor?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am fine, considering I had a heart attack on the 7th, but that's another story.
Oh, no.
It's fine. It's not a big deal.
All right.
Anyway, so actually, when you started your discussion, I was intrigued that you talked about the beverage companies, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, etc. Because years ago, I attended a seminar held by a chap. I've long forgotten his name. All I know is he was shilling for an MLM vitamin company.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, he was the trainer for the Phoenix Suns.
Okay.
And he had had a very, very serious accident in his youth. Had been bedridden, told by the doctors he'd never walk again, etc.
Right.
Did the long journey, learned everything he could. And all health professionals, even regular medical doctors, usually have one pet peeve that they focus on, right?
Right.
And in his case, it was exactly that, soda pop.
And that was years ago, you mentioned.
That was, at least 10 years ago.
Right.
And this is in Montreal. And in Laval, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pacing up and down the stage. Remember, this is a guy who had been told he'd never walk again.
Right.
And he was pacing up and down the stage. And the audience members, the ladies would raise their arms and say, well, what about diet? What about ginger ale, because it doesn't have the caffeine, etc. And they all, they tried every which way to rationalize drinking soda pop, right? And he had gone down the list and said, this is what it does to your stomach. It literally eats out, the lining of your stomach. This stuff is among the worst things you can ingest. It's literally poison.
Well, we have to be careful about that. Although it, from a calorie standpoint, it's pretty harsh. There, for the most part, most of the stuff is simply carbonated water and sugar. So our stomach itself has a pH, or an acid content, of about 3. That's the pH of the stomach, which is compared to vinegar, which is 5. And again, pH is a logarithmic scale. So vinegar is 100 times weaker than our stomach acid. So even the acidic characteristics of the soda itself is still not enough to overpower the tissue in the stomach. But I will grant you, though, that just drinking, essentially sugar water all the time is not a healthy thing to be doing.
It isn't, and in any case, and I do agree with you that the whole skew of having 2 billion people over with 1 billion people starving is not a great idea.
Well, you're even seeing now in developing countries and emerging countries. So, for example, they used in these articles India and China, where you have the more affluent parts of the countries that is, primarily the cities, where people have the income to be able to be spending money on these foods. Their weights are going up. Those that are in poverty living in the countryside, their weights are going down. They're starving. So you have this dichotomy of obesity increasing in the cities and people starving in the outlying areas. And that if that doesn't at least add one more factor to the body of evidence, you can't hang your hat on one thing, but certainly is enough to indicate that you have a problem going on when you have this introduction of these foods and these food products to populations that can afford to pay for them, and then the subsequent increase in weight that you start seeing.
Absolutely. Doctor, before I let you go,
sure.
Can I ask you one little question? You're a medical doctor, right?
Yes, so, absolutely.
Lipitor,
yes.
Right? They want me to take it, now that I've had this heart attack. Actually, they've wanted me to take it for years.
Right.
But for some reason, I've always resisted. The question I have for you is, let's say you have your HDL and LDL healthy and lousy cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
How does Lipitor actually change that ratio or lower the healthy to the unhealthy? Does the ratio actually change with taking Lipitor?
Yes, it does. What happens is it lowers the LDL and it also lowers your total cholesterol. It doesn't that doesn't necessarily affect the good stuff, the HDL, but because your ratio, that is the total cholesterol over your HDL, is something right. that's looked at as well. Right. You want to try and get a ratio that is usually below 3.5 or even lower, especially for someone who's had a heart attack and an LDL less than 2. So by lowering or reducing your total cholesterol, your ratio goes down, so that's more protective. Okay. And your LDL, the data right now demonstrates that if you can consistently keep your LDL below 2 millimoles per liter, what right. tends to happen is you get a reduction of plaque in the coronary arteries. You get a reversal, albeit slowly, a reversal of the collection of plaque and cholesterol-laden plaque in the arteries, and they tend to okay. start to get widened. So you get less blockage of the artery. So
if your HDL numbers are low, like whatever, and your LDL is in 4 point something, that's a high LDL, right?
That's a high LDL.
You'd have a lot of plaque if you had that. And the final question is, how quickly does it work?
Usually within several months, you'll see an LDL that is below 2 and a normalization of the ratio. And then it's a matter of years of doing that to be able to reverse the process. But given that you've had a heart attack, I would definitely take this because you don't want to have another one.
Well, yeah, but I what can I say? I married well. My wife, I had the heart attack on the 7th.
Right. We actually have to break for the news. If you want to hang on, we can talk a little
bit
longer. Okay, hang on a sec.
Hang on.
We'll take a break for the news. And that's about it.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Dr. Robert. You're a new and better man. He helps you to understand. He does everything he can.
And we're going to go back to the phone lines and continue our conversation with Telbis in North Lancaster. So you were having, you already, on the 7th, you had a heart attack.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, what happened was it started around 5 p.m. or so, which was a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the dizziness, and I felt the pain in my chest, and I couldn't breathe actually all night.
Right.
I couldn't actually raise my chest properly. I could only breathe like mm-hmm. with my stomach. And I had the pains down my arms, everything. But I didn't go to the hospital right away because some years previous I'd had tachycardia, like a really fast heartbeat.
Yeah.
And my local hospital, the first thing they gave me didn't work, so then they injected me with something which literally stopped my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me over a year to recover from. So I was very reticent to go to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I went at noon on Friday. They freaked out, and they mm-hmm. prepared to send me to the Ottawa Heart Institute with the heparin, drip and the whole shebang.
Yeah.
And they ambulanced me there, and I got there late Friday, and I couldn't get the angiogram until the Tuesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what kind of saved my bacon.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, it did, because that 4 days gave my wife enough time, she's a Reiki master, to clear out the plaque in my heart. And by the time they got to the angiogram, they couldn't find any plaque in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So that I didn't get a stint or nothing. Because I was a little bit worried about having this balloon in my heart. And I asked, how occluded does your valve have to be? And the doctors told me 70% before they'll put in a stent.
Right.
And by the time I got the angiogram, there was no plaque left in my arteries.
So they didn't find any blockages at all?
Nothing. The doctor was freaked. She couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They actually made me stay 2 extra days for a Doppler sonogram of my legs and another sonogram of my heart because they couldn't figure out what had happened. It was not medically, it didn't make any sense because I'd had all, like, my cholesterol numbers, from memory, I think something about 4.1
mm-hmm.
and a ratio of 6.6 or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty high.
Yeah, and that's why I asked you how quickly Lipitor can work, because my wife had asked me the day before I was scheduled to leave, because I finally did leave on the Wednesday, so I'd had the first test going in at the hospital on Saturday morning, because
mm-hmm.
they always do the blood test in the morning, and I was able to sweet-talk the blood test person to actually do the test because the nurse said it was useless so soon afterwards.
Right.
But my LDL, that's the lousy one. Yeah, that had gone down. My wife had brought that down 17% in those 3 days. Mm-hmm. And my HDL had gone up. It didn't look like a lot of difference when I first saw the numbers, but then I took out the calculator, you know, like 3.1 and 2.8. And the HDL had gone up 7%.
Now, were these done in two different labs?
No, they were done exactly at the same hospital.
Okay, yeah.
Well, at the Ottawa Heart Institute.
Right, and they established that there was indeed a heart attack.
Oh, yeah, all the enzymes and everything. I even have the paper saying that I had had a heart attack.
Did they do anything else to see what area of the heart was damaged?
Well, they did a sonogram of my heart on the Wednesday, and they couldn't find any more of the damage.
Because usually if there's a heart attack and that implies that the heart muscle was damaged, and there's usually there's ways to be able to find the tissue that's been, because heart attack means part of the heart died. That's what a heart attack means. So if there's tissue that died, there's usually a means of detecting that, and that would tell them the extent of the damage and the severity of the heart attack. If they weren't able to establish that or haven't done the tests for that, then it would be still a good question to ask if you had heart damage.
Well, they had done every possible test. Yeah. Like I said, that's why they did the sonogram on my last day. And the thing is, when the guy did, because I knew they were looking for a clot, they were trying to find something that had caused a heart attack.
Right.
They'd already done the CAT scan of the lungs on the weekend before the angiogram and found no clots.
Right.
And afterwards, they did the sonogram of the legs looking for it, and that technician was a nice guy, so I asked him, how did it look, and he answered me right away that it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the chap who did the sonogram, he was more reticent, only a doctor can tell you this, you know, so...
Right.
All right. And, vas-y, là, j'arrive. And so, basically... he wouldn't give me the answer, but they phoned later from the hospital on something else, and they didn't find anything on the sonogram. My wife was a cardiac nurse for 24 years, and she told me I did have tissue damage.
Yeah.
But, well, what can I say?
All right.
You know, I mean, a lot of people, no medical doctor will ever agree, you know, and my friend Leon and stuff, he's trying to desperately find a reason that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the only real reason is that my wife was already a talented healer to start, and then she also became a Reiki master, which helped her focus those healing energies. And she just, what can I say? I'm married well, so.
All right. Yeah. All right, Tobias. Well, I wish you well.
Thank you very much. And I do agree with you that the pop is a real, you know, that's the one thing I didn't do. I did quit smoking, though. I was a pack-a-day smoker.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, but I did quit smoking, so I'm not just relying on my wife.
Good. I'm glad. Right. Well, take it easy.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And to continue a conversation with calories and food, good afternoon to Richard in Ottawa.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I'm calling the first time because
yes.
I think... one of the main issues in, you know, we were talking about how they sort of gild a lily as far as food out there. And I'm concerned about the deceptive labeling on trans fats.
Mm-hmm.
And trans fats make so many things go wrong, including, you know, they make plaquing worse and fat metabolism is impaired and many, many other bad effects from trans fats. And yet, government has allowed labeling to pull a few fasties when they, you know, make it very confusing for people. For example, peanut butter. You used to be able to tell, you know, straight crushed peanuts from the hydrogenated emulsified peanut butter because, you know, there'd be an oil slick on the top of the just peanuts, for example, and you know, we used to get the other kind, and I grew up, you know, as a kid, everybody ate piles of peanut butter, and it was all the hydrogenated version, and you know, they disclosed on the label that it, you know, the percentage of hydrogenation in there, and now all of a sudden they show zero, and so you go and you wonder why, and it's because they've been allowed to not have to disclose the proper amount of trans fat in there if it's below 0.5 grams, I think.
I think it's 0.5% or something
or
like that.
Or 0.5%.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, they show zero. And then to comply with that small amount, they keep reducing the serving size. I think it's a volume weight thing, too.
That's an excellent point, Richard. You keep on going. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, what might have been 7, 8, or 9 and something that people should be alerted to avoid when they can go and buy just the peanuts crushed and, mm-hmm. and mix them and then put them in the fridge and it stays mixed, you know? And so it's just a little bit of inconvenience on the first jar when you buy the pure crushed peanuts, and if you chill it right away, then it stays just like the hydrogenated version. But I think there's an awful cheat going on when they put it forward as zero when you look on the ingredient list and it's the second ingredient, for goodness sake, hydrogenated oil.
Well, as I mentioned, you raise a very good point with regards to portion sizes or serving sizes. A lot of times when they put the serving sizes in there, they're either, for some products, really tiny.
Yeah.
And as a result, doesn't make it seem like there's very much in terms of calories and trans fats and other compounds in our food. And there are other times when the portion sizes are, they just don't reflect how people eat. And so, you know, they'll have, for example, salad dressings. They'll say, well, 2 tablespoons of salad dressing. Well, who puts 2 tablespoons of salad dressing
exactly.
on a salad, right?
Exactly.
So your point is very well taken, and it is one of the flaws, one of the many flaws that we have in our labeling system in this country that makes it difficult for people to be able to discern exactly what's in the food that they're eating, at least in terms of the compounds that we recognize as having a harmful effect on our health.
And very true. I mean, I have to say that Food and Drug leans a little bit in favor of the industry and not, you know, there's an outcry to the extent of people who are concerned about it mm-hmm. or knowledgeable about it, and yet they're completely ignored. I mean, they just keep on with this deceptive labeling.
And that's one of the discussion points in those articles being published in the Public Library of Science Medicine about the practices of companies and corporations that make these foods, and they just are not being scrutinized as they should be given the influence they have on our food supply. It's
exactly.
not necessarily saying they're evil. It's just they're out to make money, and they're out to make money for their shareholders, and that's part of being a business. But the point is that still doesn't obviate the need to scrutinize what's happening.
No, but I mean the you know, our healthcare system, which is practically unsustainable with all the drug costs and,
mm-hmm.
and where are they cutting doctors, which is not a good thing. But the whole industry, I would hazard a guess that a good percentage, double digit anyway, of the healthcare costs are contributed by the amount of trans fats in our foods that are consumed, and unknowingly, because of, to some degree, by deceptive labeling.
I think it's likely that, and a combination of just the calories and the diabetes
yeah.
and the heart disease and
Absolutely.
The sedentary lifestyle and
yep.
and all the stuff that's out there. Yeah, I can't argue with you, Richard. It's a point very well taken.
Okay, that's had to call.
All right, all the best to you.
Keep up your good work.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye bye now. And we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have Corrine, who has been waiting very patiently, would like to talk about a twisted bowel. Lisa in Ottawa about Paget's disease. And Guy in Overbrook has a question about a health shake. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. And we'll be back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Across the sea.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
And back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Corrine in Ottawa. Hello, Corrine.
Oh, hi, Dr.
Hi.
Ben. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not very good.
No.
I just have a question to ask you.
Sure.
About a month ago, I was went in by ambulance to the hospital, and I was just bending over with the pain, and I couldn't stand up hardly. So they did a CT scan, and they found out I had to twist the bowel, which they had to unblock.
Right.
And I was in there for about 4 days. But I find ever since I came out, I'm no better. Like, I can't go to the bathroom, and every time I eat, I feel so full, and I bloat right up.
Now, how long ago did this happen?
About a month ago.
Okay. Now, what you had was actually a very serious condition. If what I understand this from what you're describing, you had something called a volvulus. And a volvulus is when your bowel exactly does that. It twists and knots up and it blocks off. I'm sure you had pain and probably vomiting. And
yes,
and,
I did. Yeah.
And so that is extremely injurious to the bowel. That is, parts of the bowel get wounded. They get less blood supply to them. The tissue can sometimes die and can take a while to regenerate. So it's not as if you could potentially lose your bowel if it stays too long, but it sounds like they got to it early enough.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, is that it does take a while for the bowel to recover. It's not a simple matter of unknotting it and then everything returning to normal. There's likely still parts of your bowel that have been severely affected by this knotting up and are still going to take more time to heal. It does take a while for that tissue to regenerate.
I see.
The way we know that the bowel is not blocked anymore is if you are passing gas. You can have bloating, but the bloating can also occur because, again, the bowel has been damaged. You can also have the loss of certain bacteria in the bowel that are required for you to digest food properly.
Mm-hmm.
And what can be helpful sometimes, it's certainly no guarantee, but what can be helpful sometimes is consuming some of the yogurts that have probiotic bacteria or even taking probiotic supplements in capsule form to help reestablish the normal, what we call bacterial colonies that are involved in digesting your food. Because a lot of times bloating and gas result when other bacteria that really have replaced the good ones end up taking over and they produce a lot of gas when you eat food.
Oh, I see.
So that's some of the issues. But as long as gas is going through, and
yes, it is. Yeah.
Then it's not blocked anymore. And you're really dealing with an intestine that is still damaged. It's very similar. I mean, just in terms of how the body heals, it's like if you were to, you know, God forbid, but you fall and you break your arm.
Right.
Well, you break your arm. They put the arm back in place. They put a cast on it. But the arm is still, even though they put a cast on it and they've straightened it out, it still doesn't work well for at least another 6 or 8 weeks because it has to heal up. Well, the bowel had an injury that was quite severe if it ended up getting knotted up. And because of that, it does take sometimes up to 2 months for that bowel to heal completely. And again, it wasn't a small injury. This is a significant type of injury that happens to the bowel.
And they told me it could possibly happen again, too.
They have to be vigilant about this. I'm sure you're going to be following up with the gastroenterologist or your surgeon.
Yes.
To make sure that the bowel is functioning properly. But yes, it is. If you get pain like that again, and that's the key thing. With a bowel that knots up like that, you get sudden onset of severe, severe pain.
Right.
Then you head right back to the hospital because that's getting bloated without any pain, unlikely to be the bowel twisting up. But getting pain like that, which I'm sure was quite severe, is enough to cause you to have a significant problem. And so, yeah, absolutely, you would go to the emerge again if that happened.
Yeah, that's what my doctor told me.
Right.
Yeah.
But I could.
But there's nothing you can take to make your bowel, like, to go?
There is. I mean, there are a few things. If you're constipated, Now, when you go to the bathroom, is the stool hard or soft?
It's hard.
Yeah. So one of the things that's safe to take, because you don't want anything to irritate the bowel, one of the things that is safe to take is something called there's different brands, but I'll just mention a couple of them that I know. One of them is called Pegalax. Another one is called Laxaday. And the other one, I think, is called Restoralax.
Oh, yes. I've seen that in the stores.
Right.
Yes.
And those help keep water in your intestine to keep the stool softer.
I see.
And they don't hurt the intestine. It's very safe to take. We give this to even infants that are constipated.
Mm-hmm.
The Chio does this all the time, and it can be used over the long term because it doesn't make the bowel lazy. The bowel still works properly. It just keeps water in the bowel.
Oh, well, that's
good.
And
then there's also eating foods that will help your bowel function. So things like grapes and prunes and apples and corn, those things will tend to help your bowel function more properly.
Okay.
So what you eat is also very important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you very much. It's so good to know that.
Oh, you're very welcome, Corrine.
Thank you.
All the best.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line one and Lisa in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I tried getting through on Wednesday, but unfortunately didn't make it through. I recently found out that my father has Paget's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, being the emotional one in the family, I'm the last to know. So I'd like to know more from your point of view more about the topic, because I do hear that it can be hereditary. And I have done some research on it, but I'd rather hear from a physician.
Sure. Well, first of all, Paget's disease usually occurs in people over the age of 55. It tends to be a much later stage disease and is involved with bone that gets reabsorbed too much. The cells that are responsible for absorbing the bone beat out the cells that make bone, and as a result, bone starts to break down, and you tend to see this in the skull or on the spine or long bones of the body, and there's increased risk of fractures. There are genetic components to it, but it is usually what we call an autosomal dominant, meaning that your dad has to have the gene that is dominant to give to you in order for this to happen. That being said, whether it is genetic or whether it is another condition that leads to this, it is extremely well controlled with medications, because it's the specific cell in the bone that's overactive, and there are medications, the same ones that are used to treat osteoporosis, that are used to control this and work very well at controlling the cell. And so you don't get the bone breakdown anymore. It rebalances things out. So for yourself, it's something to watch. There are tests that can be done over time if this is suspected. But again, until somebody is complaining of increasing pain in the bones, has suffered a fracture, it's not something that you would screen for per se. You're not going to be subjected to x-rays all the time or do bone densities all the time. Because again, if someone is functioning well, then, you know, what are we going to do to make things any better? But the main symptoms, so for yourself, the symptoms would be arthritis. About 50% of people complain of arthritic pain, just generalized pain, bone deformities start to happen. You see little bumps on bones. That's the kind of stuff that happens.
Yes, I've noticed that with regards to any breakage or fractures, the bone doesn't heal properly, and therefore, like you would notice someone who would have like a bowed leg.
Yeah. Lisa, so unfortunately, we have 10 seconds left. I have to go.
Very well. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye
okay,
now.
Bye-bye.
And the bottom line to all of this, the keg carrot cake, for those listening, 2,344 calories, 65 teaspoons of sugar, 7 teaspoons short of 1.5 cups of sugar in that piece of cake. Worse than all the other ones. I can go through the other list at the end of our next show. We got to go. Thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. Everyone have a great week and great Canada Day, and we'll be back on July the 8th.